Our third speaker this morning is Brother Harry Tennant from Watford Ecclesia in the United Kingdom. And the theme for Brother Tennant's classes this week is Moses, the Lord's Messenger. And his fourth class this morning is entitled, How Can I Myself Alone Bear You? Brother Tennant.
Well, thank you, Brother Chairman, and good morning, brethren and sisters. I don't suppose, really, we take on board what Moses meant when he said, How can I, myself, alone, bear all your cumbrance and all your strife? All of us have problems to carry. We have personal problems, we have the problems of our family and each of our individual children. And then the problems that come with being in a home and trying to keep a home going, belonging to an ecclesia or belonging to a neighbourhood where we have in some way to relate to the people who are around us. And then we have the responsibility and burden of our daily jobs, the responsibility of becoming responsible people. When you get to a certain age, you think that my responsibilities will gradually get less. You will discover that never takes place. And it's not deliberate, it's how it is. That's how life is. You see that our responsibilities increase and shift along. We do get rid of some of them, but then you discover that they all come back in another form. And I suppose as you get older, then there are responsibilities about getting older or not being able to remember as you remembered on one occasion and so on. And these will never cease. But for Moses, they were thrust at him. They were not things he looked for, and they weren't entirely his responsibilities. They were the responsibilities of the Lord God himself. And God had no one else but Moses to represent him. Moses knew that, and he felt it. But he also felt that there is a limit to what Moses can do. How can I, myself, alone? And those are dread words when you just think that he expresses himself in that way. Bear all your cumbrance and all your strife. There's only one man who was able to do that, and that was the Lord Jesus Christ. And he didn't ask the question that Moses asked, because the Lord will lay upon him the iniquity of us all. And that's what he carried. I want this morning to have a look at some of the problems of Moses, just as they were, and just see what it was that he had to carry that was almost impossible. So just come to, first of all, Exodus chapter 32. It's hard for us to understand how anybody could be in a mountain 40 days and 40 nights without food and in constant communication with God. Now, it's almost impossible to grasp any of that. I imagine that the most that any of us has ever done is perhaps 3 days of that. But 40 days and 40 nights without intermission was what had happened to Moses. He's been in the mount, and Joshua is a little distance away. Aaron is no longer there. That incident has happened when he brought up the elders of Israel, and they saw the God of Israel. That was a vision for them, to sustain them in their own particular way, so that they could relate to Moses, who was related to God. 40 days are over, and they're going to return home, back to the camp. And it was hard. Moses was carrying 2 tablets of stone, written by the finger of God. And he is on a mission now to deliver what he's learned to the people and to bring them to provide for the tabernacle. That's what's happening. And Moses had lived in a rarefied atmosphere. On such an occasion as this, when he came away, his face was shining, so it says. He actually reflected the glory of God in a way that was quite disconcerting to those who saw him. It wasn't the Moses they knew. And they had to learn, and he learned how to cope with that for their sakes. And now it says in verse 15 of chapter 32, "And Moses turned and went down from the mount, and the two tables of the testimony were in his hand. The tables were written on both sides, on the one side and on the other were they written. And the tables were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God graven upon the tables." So these were very exceptional tablets of God. But as they descend, a noise comes to their ears. I imagine it's the kind of noise that Brother Roger has described on one or two occasions. Because here it involves Joshua as well. And in verse 17, "And when Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, he said unto Moses, there is a noise of war in the camp." He said, it is not the voice of mastery. It's not what happens in battle with all the cries as men go to and fro, and then some of them are the cries of death. It's not the voice of them that cry for being overcome, but the noise of them that sing do I hear. So this is interesting, isn't it? This is the kind of song that came to them from down below. And when he came into the camp, and it's hard to imagine, how can I, myself, alone, bear all your cumbrance and all your strife? Because here, it's all gone wrong. They've got a molten calf. They've set up mixed worship of Yahweh and idolatry together. And they are dancing round the calf naked. This is riotous living. This is what they're doing. Moses is completely overcome. That's when the tablets are broken as he throws them with both hands to the ground. And then gets to work on cleaning up this people as best he can. And comes to the moment when he stands in the gate of the camp and says, "Who is on the Lord's side?" And it's the Levites who come. This is why they have their name then. And the name that's carried forward from now on. They did the right thing at the right time in the right place. Dreadful as it was, they were armed. And they were to go through the camp and kill on the right hand and on the left. And so this was a dreadful business. But that's what had to be done to quell this lustful behavior with all its noise and none of it memorable at all. A people that dissolute and turned away from God and wanted to go back into the land of Egypt. And Moses then hears God speaking to him. And it's not comfortable, that which he hears. And there are ways in which God switches the language now that places a tremendous responsibility on Moses, as though he were responsible for what's happened. Just look what God says in chapter 33. "Depart," verse 1, "and go up hence, thou and the people which thou hast brought out of the land of Egypt, out of the land which I swear, unto the land which I swear unto Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, saying, unto thy seed will I give this land." He elaborates the nations who are already there. And then he says, and this leaves Moses absolutely desolate. He says, "For I will not go up in the midst of thee." Just imagine you're Moses. And you turn and see all this people, and God says, "I'm not going to go with you. I'm not going to be in the midst of your camp." To which Moses could have said, "But Lord, you promised to dwell in Israel. You've given me the details about the tabernacle. And it depends on that." And now Moses is revealed as a man of profound and wondrous prayer. A man of pleading, of atonement. A man of such beseeching that you see God, as it were, change under his hand. This is what really takes place. This is all for Moses' benefit. God knows exactly what will happen, as he does with our own lives. God prepares us for the things that are coming. If we're his people, he prepares us for the things that are coming. Even when we're overtaken by tragedy, God knew about it beforehand and he prepares us for it. And we've got to believe that, brethren and sisters. Otherwise we don't believe in the Bible, that in the God that's described in our Bible. So here now Moses begins, and it's out of profound faith to seek to change the circumstances that God has created. And so here it is. There's been a great change in the camp. Moses has moved his personal tent out of the midst of the camp. It's called the tabernacle, almost as though it's the tabernacle of Moses, but that hasn't been built. And this is right outside the camp. He's taken it right away. Joshua is inside it, and there is Moses. He's removed himself from the camp. Now it's interesting, because he's worried about God moving out of the camp. Now it's interesting, that, isn't it? And so you can see that there is, in a way, there's a double lesson going on here for Moses. I'm not suggesting that Moses forsook Israel here. He was teaching them a very deep lesson. If you want to know about God, you must come outside the camp, and you must come to me. And the people were so scared of Moses that when Moses stood up to go out to that tent, everybody stood at the door of their tent. There was a very strange majesty about Moses, and a very considerable severity. But now God has said that he will speak face to face with Moses. So that cloud comes down and stands at the door of Moses' tent. Joshua is inside and hears every exchange that takes place. And God speaks, as it were, with Moses face to face. There's no clouding of issues by language or vision. This is an exchange of words. Now we read Moses' heart. Verse 12. "And Moses said unto the Lord, See, thou sayest unto me, Bring up this people, and thou hast not let me know whom thou wilt send with me. Yet thou hast said, I know thee by name, and thou hast found grace in my sight. Now therefore, I pray thee, if I have found grace in thy sight, show me now thy way, that I may know that I may find grace in thy sight." And consider that this nation is thy people. So that's reversing what there was in verses 1 and 2. When God says, "You brought up this nation, this people, they're yours, Moses." And he says, "Lord, they're your people." And then God assures him and says, and he said, "My presence shall go with thee, and I will give thee rest." Now those are words that echo down the corridors of time, and are still echoing to and fro until the very day when those will be fulfilled. They haven't been completed yet, but here was the promise that Moses, despite all that's happened, I will go with you. Now Moses takes hold of that right, he's very much like Abraham, takes hold of that right away and uses it as a basis for his further prayer. And he said unto him, if thy presence go not with me, carry us not up thence. I don't want to go if you're not going with me. Now, brothers and sisters, that's a basis for life. If we go to places or go with the spirits that is not acceptable to God, we can't go with God, and we shouldn't go without God. There's no way into the kingdom without God. And we then use this in our daily experiences. When you go for an interview for a job, then do you really think when you go in for this interview that you're actually, that on the other side of the table in the other room it will be God who is there? Or do you just leave it all as though God has no part in it? That can't be right. I know some sisters have difficulties with their neighbours and their neighbours' children. Well, this is a matter for prayer. There's no magic solution to these things, but in actual fact we've got to pray about it and tell God about it and say that you want him there. Lord, come and see and help me. Now, and this is not familiarity with God. It's not that at all. This is a dependence upon God. And so Moses now says, if you don't go with me, I do not want to go. And so he says here, you know, verse 16, for wherein shall it be known here that I and thy people have found grace in thy sight? Is it not that thou goest with us? And so we shall be separated. And that's a word right from plague time. It's a word from put a difference between. That's the word that is here. It's one that's taken out of, I think it's Exodus 11. You've done this with us, Lord. And if you don't go with us, how will the people know that we are a different people? We will be a godless people without your presence. And it really is astonishing. Just look what God now says. This is our God. And the Lord said unto Moses, I will do this thing also that thou hast spoken. At the behest of Moses, this arises. God knew all this, but this is a new Moses. Moses is growing with the responsibility that he has to carry. He thinks that he can crack under it. He says, I will crack if you're not with me, Lord. But if you're going with me, I will go. And then Moses, listen, because this is prayer of a superlative kind. He says, for thou hast found grace in my sight, and I know thee by name. And Moses immediately follows that up. Immediately, he says, I beseech thee, show me thy glory. He said, I will make all my goodness pass before thee, and I will proclaim the name of the Lord before thee, and I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and will show mercy on whom I will show mercy. And then we come to one of those, you know the phrase, and it never diminishes in its beauty and its assurance. Verse 21. And the Lord said, behold, there is a place by me, brethren and sisters. That applies to all of us. This is not God saying, stand over there, don't approach. It's God saying, there's a place by me. There's no greater assurance than this. And the next words, and they're not full in the authorized version there. It isn't thou shalt stand upon a rock, thou shalt stand upon the rock. That's what it is. By God is the rock. The rock is Christ, isn't it? Of course it is. But he's actually telling us that there's a place for you. Individually, personally, you. I mean you, that's what God is saying. Oh, true, here it's Moses, but here is a principle that's so beautifully clear. And Moses receives this revelation of the name of God in all its fullness. It's not just a word that we might imagine that we know the Hebrew, and some of us might even think that we can pronounce it. But it seems very rarely that do we pronounce it as a Hebrew would pronounce it. So it's not the word, it's what lies behind it that he is. And you would never have done this, brethren and sisters. You'd have had it the other way round. He said, the Lord God, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth. You wouldn't have put mercy first, would you? We don't put it first in many of the things that we do. This was a dreadful situation for God. But God reveals himself first as merciful. This is how it should be in any dispute. In family life or with children, mercy should be first. You know, we say, oh, well, you can't have mercy unless you get truth first. The fact is, we're not in the position to receive truth. There's no way in which we can receive truth without mercy. We come from a generation that's danced around the molten calf. That's what the world is. We live in a riotous world and sometimes bring it into our houses by the things that we do. The only way is mercy. That's what God says. Thy mercy and thy truth, said the patriarchs of old. So now, Moses is now praying. And, you know, it's fascinating to see this man pray. He's now pleading for the nation in verse 9. And he's asking, and notice this, he's asking, he's taking God back to God's first words to him. And so he says in verse 9, if now I have found grace in thy sight, O Lord, let my Lord, I pray thee, go in the midst of us. That's the words we've got among us. He says it's more than that. He's picking up the words that were there at the beginning of the exchange in chapter 32. And pardon this people. And so God now hears Moses riding on the tide of God's mercy towards him. He thought he was so near to shipwreck with all that had happened before. He brought these people, and of course he had. And here they are, dancing round Egypt's gods. And yet assembling in the name of God to do it. That's what they're doing. And Moses has now had a vision. And a moment when he's had to hide his own eyes and bow down while God makes himself known to him. What a marvelous thing. And what a wonderful man. When he pleads with God, he says to him, let thy mercy... No, he says, let thy power be great as thou hast said. And you think, oh, well now, what Moses is asking for is that he wants some show of the magnificence of the power of God. He says, no. The power of God is not that. And he's pleading for the people. He says, let the power of my Lord be great according as thou hast spoken. That you are gracious and merciful. That's the power of God. Forgiveness. We treat it lightly as though it's just a thing you just ask for and it comes. Just falls out of the clouds like the manna. You know, to ask God to forgive, it's tremendous. Only the power of God can do that. And that's what Moses is pleading for. And so he's coming to, and he'll come then into chapter 35, learning again from God, and finally they'll do the wondrous work of the tabernacle. We can't stay longer with that one. Now come to Numbers chapter 12. Numbers chapter 12. This is hard. His sister and his brother now complain. This is family trouble. Miriam, who stood and watched when he was by the Nile, and Aaron, who's been called by God to meet him and empowered in various ways, they complain to Moses about his marriage. And whether this is in fact Zipporah or whether it is another woman that he has married, whichever it is, and man needs consolation. And in our marriages, this is how we understand each other. We need each other when we're in marriage. I know some of us are not married, and God is our husband then. But for others who marry, there is a consolation beyond any kind of explanation, that there is consolation with your partner. Someone on whom you lean, who is leaning on you. And you share things deeper and instinctively, because that's what marriage is about. So Moses had married, and that was part of the comfort in Moses' own life, which we can't now intrude upon. But they now say, God's spoken through you. We understand that, but he's also spoken through us. Miriam the prophetess, and Aaron in this special work. Isn't it true then that we're all on the same footing? Isn't that right? And it then provides, it is wonderful how these circumstances provide things that you never forget. Here it is. And the Lord heard it. Now the man Moses was very meek above all the men which were upon the face of the earth. That's terrific, isn't it, eh? He's not the proud grabber for power that they were alleging. But the Lord spake instantly, suddenly, right away. A little crowd came down and separated Miriam and Aaron. Explains that if God has to speak, this is the way he will speak. To you, perhaps, Miriam, as the prophetess, or to you, Aaron. But I don't speak to Moses like that. I speak to Moses face to face. Why were you not then afraid to speak against my servant Moses, eh? Oh. Meanwhile, Miriam has turned completely leprous. Altogether. White as snow. There she is. It says so. And Aaron turned his face and saw her. And immediately, now notice what he really has in his heart for Moses. He uses a word that the opening verses of this chapter would never have been used, because they thought they were all equals. And it says that in verse 11, and Aaron said unto Moses, Alas, my Lord. Alas, my Lord. That tells you what he knows. He knows that situation is right. Moses is Aaron's Lord, even though he is the meekest man on earth. And we know that. We've met the other man, meek and lowly and riding upon an ass. They say we've done foolishly, and all of us can echo that. So 7 days she is isolated, put without the camp. There was no way back unless God healed her, and he did, and they moved on. Now you know, these are circumstances that are hard to believe. And now, even though Miriam and Aaron have been corrected, and Miriam's had this frightening experience, and Aaron has been brought himself, as it were, to his knees in Moses, that means that they will never be the same. Their relation with Moses will be different. And in another sense, it makes Moses more alone than before. He hasn't got anybody he can trust. Nobody at all. And these chapters in Numbers are now just, well, they're developing Moses, but what a mob of people. Look at just chapter 14. The reason is, you see, that in chapter 13 they've chosen the representatives for the 12 spies. There they are, all listed. There's nobody from the tribe of Levi, which is interesting. And it's made very clear to us in the opening of Deuteronomy that only the people who were numbered for war are the generation that will die. It does not say that the Levites will die. We always say Moses, we always say it's Joshua and Caleb. They were numbered men. But when it comes to death, and you read it carefully in the beginning of Deuteronomy, it says the men that were armed for war were the generation who would die. So that's the situation that is here. The Levites were not armed for war, and they were not numbered as the armed people. But that's just in passing, and they're mentioned in this chapter. And they fail in the work that they do, and when they come back, oh my, there's a bunch of grapes, you know. And I take it was a bunch. It was probably, you know, feet high and feet wide. It took two men to carry it on shoulders. This wasn't just, you know, picked up from a fruit stall or something like that. This is the fruit of the land. Everything was right. Just what God had said was there. The land was a fruitful land. It was a land with streams, plenty of water, beautiful, beautiful land. But there were giants there. That's the trouble with life, isn't it? We've all got buts. Oh, I do it, but we've all got giants. And the great problem is that our giants are always bigger than we are. To which the response is, there must be something wrong with your God then. Is the giant bigger than God? Is the problem you've got bigger than God? Is that what you're saying? The giants have all been slain. Caleb was ready to go out and do them himself right away. So great was his faith. He's going to be 85 before he takes them on. Joshua and Caleb are going to spend 40 years, 38 extra years, waiting in the wilderness, although they were faithful men. You see, our mistakes involve other people. Just imagine, inflicting on Joshua and on Caleb 38 years of extra waiting, when they were the faithful men. That's what happens. This is what fellowship is all about. It's not some mechanical kind of thing. It's a true involvement of people and hearts and principles. That's what is set out here. And they didn't want to know. God intervened, and now Moses is blamed for God's work. And God had to defend Moses once again. Now this is what he's seeking to handle. How can I, myself alone, bear all your cumbrance and all your strife? The 70 men who were appointed, on whom God distributed the Spirit, were not for this task. They couldn't rise to this. This was for settling disputes among the Gentiles, among the Jews, between individuals, but not for this. There was no one who could rise to this. Only Moses in his prayer. And God gets tired. Chapter 14 and verse 26. And the Lord spake unto Moses and Aaron, saying, How long shall I bear with this evil congregation? murmuring against me. This is the chapter with, as truly as I live, all the earth shall be filled with my glory. Running parallel with that was this great evil. But here is that phrase that I quoted. Here is the great intervention. Just have a look at verse 17. And now I beseech thee, let the power of my Lord be great, according as thou hast spoken, saying, the Lord is long-suffering and of great mercy, and forgiving iniquity and transgression, and will no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generations. Pardon, I beseech thee, the iniquity of this people, according to thy power. And thy power, it says, is the greatness of thy mercy. That's God's power. We think of other things, like we had yesterday with the mount all trembling. That was just a fringe of God's power, as though the Lord just for a moment made it tremble. But this is right from God himself. That's where it comes from. It doesn't come through the Lord Jesus Christ. This is where it lies. You know, I think, and perhaps these thoughts you wouldn't think through for yourself, just simply that I say to myself, Lord, that name you've revealed, is that your name, and have you always been like that? And the Lord's answer surely is, this is who I am. Merciful and gracious. Yes. But, Lord, there must have been a time when there was nobody there to be merciful and gracious to. And you were still merciful and gracious. That's what God is. That's why there was creation. It was out of this that... And he knew what would happen. But that which would prevail and finally be triumphant would be, in fact, God's forgiveness. And so in the final letter, you know, the final book, then we have, these are they who have washed themselves, their robes, and made them white in the blood of the Lamb, provided by God. This is God's Lamb. This is his mercy. So don't faint about your sins. Deeply regret and rue them, certainly. But God's power is greater than the giants. There isn't a sin, except the rejection of God himself, that God cannot forgive. Not that we trade upon that, we would do that at our peril. Because then we would come immediately into the other part of the name of God. That God will punish that. So let's learn to rest upon him. Now come for a moment, just for a moment, to chapter 16. We've already had trouble with the family. That was Miriam and Aaron. We now have trouble with another relation of Moses. This is Korah, and he is related to Moses. There isn't any greater problem to handle, is there, than dispute within the family. I'm sorry, I can't speak from experience there, but I know that's true for some of you. That it's the family that's the problem. If it isn't just within your own married circle, then it's a bit wider, perhaps your parents or uncles or whoever it is, and that you've always got a problem within the family. Well, that's what happens in this chapter. There is a major insurrection taking place in this chapter. Major. This man Korah was no fool. He was in the sense of not understanding God. But in meeting the things of his life, he went to work about it in a methodical way. On the south side of the camp, when they were pitched, then Korah was near the tent of Reuben. And Korah had got a problem with God. You see, when God had chosen within his own family, I don't mean his immediate family, but when he chose, then in actual fact, it wasn't the firstborn that was taken, and somebody else was taken. And that gave Korah a scope for saying to Reuben, I know you were the firstborn. And I know that this has passed to Joseph, to Judah. But I understand now how you feel. And we've got problems here in this camp. You see, it really is a case for the Monopolist Commission. Moses has cornered the market. And he makes quite sure that the people that he wants are given the plum jobs. And so this stirring was such that Reuben, the Korah, Dathan and Abiram from Reuben, as such, thought, yes, you're quite right, Korah. You are quite right. And whatever you want to do, we'll line up with you. And so they do. It's interesting because, and before I forget it, I better just point out one little thing, very rarely mentioned in discussion of this incident, and that is that it wasn't just Korah, Dathan and Abiram from the Reubenites. There was somebody else as well. And there he is, Korah, he's with Dathan, Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben. So there was this man, On, the son of Peleth. He doesn't appear later on. It looks as though this man repented of his condition. He does not appear amongst those whose tents are swallowed up. So what appeared to be a monolithic rebellion isn't so. It never is. Never is, in any circumstance. There's always some weakness in human structure. That's what the nature of human nature is, isn't it? And so just take it that I believe that this man Peleth repented of his condition. And before I forget the other point, namely, and that is, that Korah was not a good father. His sons did not agree with him. And in 1 Chronicles 26 we are told quite distinctly that the sons of Korah were not destroyed. That's why we've got Psalms for the sons of Korah. And they wouldn't have been there if the sons of Korah in the beginning had not been repentant people. They did not have to have anything to do with their father in this rebellion. But this man Korah needs a wider base on which to work. You can't just work on these few people from Reuben. After all, the nature of the rebellion that he's stirring up is that he's now going to attack frontally Moses and the priesthood. That's what he's going to do. So he broadens the base by making quite sure that 250 princes from the other tribes, from all the tribes, are going to be part of the rebellion. And they're there in verse 2. This man is a cunning workman and a thorough workman. He's as bad in his evil as Jezebel was in hers. She was no slouch about applying things. She was very dedicated to evil, but she worked at it with both hands earnestly, as it says in one of the minor prophets. So here we are, verse 3, they gathered themselves against Moses and against Aaron. And here it is. Aaron had heard these words before. They were partly his, and Miriam had heard them. Ye take too much upon you. Haven't you read? These are my brackets. Exodus chapter 19. But you remember those words when God made all the nation holy and said you're going to be a kingdom of priests? What's this business about separating yourselves into an upper class? The creme de la creme. Is that what you are? The congregation is holy. And the Lord is among them. You know, here are... This man was a very thorough workman. Why do you lift yourselves up above the congregation? And here it is. If you want to kill me, Korah, here I am. And Moses heard it and fell upon his face. He spake to them, saying, and he uses a dread word. He now says, even tomorrow, the very word that had fallen like a chime of death upon Pharaoh with the plagues, tomorrow, and he now says it to Korah. Whether God had revealed what was to happen to Moses, I'm not sure. The feeling I have is that what he says now sprang out of his own heart and faith, not because God had commanded him. God will show tomorrow who belonged to him. So he says, tomorrow you will meet at the tabernacle with all the princes and you yourself. So that's what is appointed for tomorrow. Just in passing, it looks as though Korah had provided another tabernacle at which to worship. Perhaps it was the tabernacle in which all the conspiracy took place. You see, it's mentioned in verse 23, the tabernacle of Korah. And I don't think that's just his home. It's not the word Ohel for tent at all. This is the Mishkan. He provided his own Mishkan. That's what he'd done. And it's repeated again in verse 27. So there was some meeting place, I feel, that Korah had stirred up. So tomorrow came. This man is no slouch. Watch him. All the people that were commanded to turn up tomorrow, turn up. Together with the whole congregation. So everybody is now for Korah. That's what's happening. He gets to work. He leaves nothing to chance, this man. That's in verse 19, have a look. And Korah gathered all the congregation against them unto the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, and the glory of the Lord appeared. And so here is the moment of truth. Here are the burning censers of these 250 men. They've got their incense and fire and the smoke ascending. They're all here, and Korah thought he had it made, because everybody's for me and there's nobody with you, Moses and Aaron. That's where you deserve to be. But the Lord then showed who was on his side. Separate yourselves from this congregation. Twice, it's made very clear to Moses in his life. Look, he said, I'll destroy everybody except you, and I'll make a new nation out of you. Moses just dismissed it. He'll say, you can't do that, Lord. The Egyptians will say, the reason you've done that is because you couldn't get us into the land. That's what they'll say. And your name will be besmirched by that. No, that can't be right, Lord. I mean, it wasn't worthwhile in any case, because if Moses had produced a nation, then they would have been rebellious, because they came from the same nature. But that wasn't what God was saying. I'll do it for you, Moses. I will do it. He mentioned it here. Just separate yourselves. Then Moses calls for Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. Well, Dathan and Abiram, and they won't come. They refuse to come. So he has to go to them. The time has gone, by the way. But you know what they do in the United Nations, when, and also they do it in the European Union. When they've got a business that must be settled, they stop the clocks. So it's now all done before midnight, you know. I'm not going to go on long, but the thing is, this incident is so instructive, brethren and sisters. You can see how trouble arises and what people do. Ringleaders of the thoroughgoing kind leave nothing to chance. I mean, strike leaders bring the strikers out. Korah brought the whole nation out. Everybody. Everybody is there now. When God appears and God says, separate yourselves from the tents of these men, Korah and Dathan and Abiram. Dathan and Abiram just don't want to come. Their arrogance and their treatment of Moses was shocking. So Moses took the elders and they went to the tents of these people. And there they were, leaning stubbornly against their tent poles and disdaining Moses. You know, and it must have been An awful moment for Moses himself. But now Moses says, now look. And the appeal has gone to these men, and they don't want to know, and their families are there, their wives and their children. He says, now if what happens to these men is such as has happened before, if this is in the ordinary run of things, then I am not God's appointed man. If the ground opens and swallows them up, and he'd hardly spoken those words before it did. And all Israel heard the cry of the people falling into the abyss. The word Tartarus is used by Peter about this. You better look that up in the concordance describing it. They went down alive into the pit, these men. And God discriminated between them and all the tents of Israel. All the men who gathered with Korah now began to repent in panic, thinking that they too are going to be destroyed. You only read the record of Korah as to whether he was destroyed in that way or by the fire, and list all the scriptures, you are still left wondering just exactly how God dealt with him. You see, he was a rebel. Kohathite, that's what he was. He wasn't just an ordinary man, he wasn't a Reubenite. He wasn't just the ordinary congregation. And consequently he was destroyed, and perhaps destroyed by fire. Whichever of the two it is, it was his last day. Oh, he'd had a moment of glory, but like a moth to the candlelight, he was to go right out. There'd be no Korah, nothing left of tomorrow, nothing at all. So he and the 250 princes, all dead, and their censers left on the floor, and said, gather them up, get them up, just get them together, they're holy, they went before the Lord. I'll make plates for the altar so that everybody who worships might remember the rebellion, and that the only place for a rebellion to stop is at the altar. Well, that's true amongst us as brethren and sisters. The place that we stop all quarrelling is at the altar. That's where we stop. And that's how people had to learn the deep lesson. We try to solve problems other ways, don't we? You know. But the fact is, and it's odd, isn't it, you know, that the atonement is said to be a problem. Of course it is. Because we're a problem. That's what the atonement is all about. But we've got then to apply that in our families, in our ecclesias, amongst brethren. We've got to do that. We've got to settle things by the atonement. No giant is bigger than the atonement. So let us, brethren and sisters, in everything, bring ourselves before God. Remember the awfulness of these things. And then, just finally, what did the people do? They come back the next day and say, you've killed the people of the Lord. That's what you've done. So here's the desperate evil of men's hearts, eh? Must have been awful. This man Moses, how can I, myself, alone, bear all your cumbrance and all your strife? Plague went out, you remember? And Aaron obeyed what Moses said. He took his censer and ran between the living and the dead and stopped the plague. Very interesting incident and full of all kinds of lessons. And God says, well now, just put the 12 rods, get 12 rods and put them into the tabernacle and leave it to me. And so that rod, and here they are, and the rod of Aaron is amongst them, and that dry rod, tomorrow not only has it sprouted into life and leaf, it's come forth with buds, it's flowered, it's done everything, and almonds are there when it's brought forth. And all the men saw this, because they'd written their own names on their own rods, so they knew all right. And they came for them one by one. So in the end, problems will be solved in completeness on the day of resurrection. And only if we remember that which was on the candlestick was an almond tree, that's what it was shaped like an almond tree, that the lamp is the promise of resurrection. That the light of God has all these things for us. And it's an opportunity to remember that we will bear fruit when Christ returns. What a marvelous moment, eh? What a wonderful day. And Moses will meet the man. I doubt whether he will remember him in this way, though we do. How can I, myself, alone? And the Lord laid upon him the iniquity of us all. That's how Christ brought about our redemption. Brethren, sisters, let's take this to our hearts. Don't stir up strife, rebellion, resentment. Don't angle for office and place. There's only one place for all of us, and that's the bottom of the ladder, and don't try to climb it. He that is low need fear no fall. When you're at the lowest place, you can't fall. That's why Christ was so wonderful, and while he stood. And let us then, in the great day of Christ, let's pray and think about it and dedicate our hearts to it. And oh, what praise we'll sing on that day. Then it will be, "Worthy is the Lamb." And I'm sure that the singing in that time will be of the highest possible quality. It will be just exactly what the Lord himself has produced. And your voice, my dear brother, my dear sister, just if you trust in the Lord and seek to do his will on the basis of the truth that you've already believed, your voice will be there in harmony and in strength with all your brothers and your sisters at every age.